From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, as always, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about the overdiagnosis of medical care. What are the risks? We often think of that second opinion as really having a benefit, but sometimes the benefit is not really there. Mm-hmm. And then an ARP report about caregivers. As baby boomers age, they're going to need people who help them bathe and shower and so on. And there may be a problem with that because there are not enough people.
What's our recipe?
Smoked turkey and cranberry salad. Wonderful, wonderful to have a salad this time of year. Turkey is my absolute favorite poultry. I think, Tom, even you will love this.
I believe it. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our first caller is in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I was calling to find out. My girlfriend does this workout, and every day after her workout, she drinks a beer. She says that beer drinking is good after her workout. And I was calling to find out if that's true or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think it is or don't you think it is?
I don't think so. I think it'd be bad because I think it adds too many calories and she's trying to lose weight. And I think it makes her gain weight, more weight, use drinking the beer.
So we have a Judge Zorba.
we definitely have a Judge Zorba on here. But before I start, I have to have full disclosure. In Wisconsin, we have a run called the Crazy Legs Run,
right?
Which is a run in the springtime. And Tom, do you know what they serve at the end of the Crazy Legs Run?
It's required, I think.
It's required that they give you beer at the end of the Crazy Legs Run. It's not a marathon.
But that's
a Wisconsin thing. It's a Wisconsin thing.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, you often are dehydrated when you exercise, and so you want to have something to drink. But having a beer after you exercise and you want to lose weight, I don't think that's the greatest idea, you know, of all. But let's first of all look from a caloric point of view.
Yeah.
Let's put the alcohol to the side for a second. If you're having a beer that's 64 calories or 100 calories, that's going to be less than having a glass of, we'll say, orange juice that might be, you know, 20 ounces of orange juice. I don't know the exact number, but is roughly 180 to 200 calories.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to do better off with a 64-calorie beer than that. But, of course, at the end of a workout, alcohol, at the end of a workout, you're dehydrated, and you're going to take something that's going to cause some vasodilatation. I would say I'm going to come down completely on your side. I don't have my gavel, but I do have my fist. Bang. I agree with you. You should not have a beer at the end of your workout.
Let me get in on this.
Oh, okay. Here we have Tom.
I hate to question the judge, but we're talking a beer here, Zorba.
Uh-huh.
We're not talking about a six-pack or a couple of
That's
mixed
true.
Drinks. Uh-huh. A beer uh-huh. is going to make uh-huh. that much difference. Uh-huh. Seems to me it doesn't matter.
Well, the reality is if you want to lose weight, a beer is calories. Those are calories. And so if you want to lose weight, you're adding extra calories that you don't need.
Yeah.
So from a caloric point of view, that makes a difference. 100 calories a day less to 150 calories a day less is 2.5 to 3 pounds less weight at the end of the year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for
Appreciate
calling.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And on we go, Zorba, this time to St. Louis, Missouri. Hello.
Hi there.
What's up?
Well, I was calling about my daughter's hand, actually. I playfully call it her claw, but I guess it's more rightfully called trigger finger.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted to find out a little bit about the treatments and what all can be done.
Uh-huh. Your daughter's had it for how long?
It's recently developed. She took a job several months ago mm-hmm. working at a restaurant, so mm-hmm. she does a lot of prep work, a lot of cutting, you know, grasping uh-huh. knife and cutting a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really gotten bad. She has to
Oh, it's hard.
Yeah. Fortunately, pop two fingers back in the morning.
We've talked about that, sir, but just for those who don't know, what is trigger?
Well, trigger finger is when you close your hand. It's a problem with the tendon. So close your hand, close your second or third finger, and then trigger finger is where you can't just open it up. It kind of goes pop. You almost have to push it open, and sometimes people do to get it to open up, just like a trigger on a gun. That's just what it feels like. Your daughter's how old?
She's 21.
She's 21. She's had this for a while or just recently came up?
It's recently, over the last 6 months or so. Uh-huh.
Well, I'll tell you, the first treatment that I would do with trigger finger is get a steroid injection into the tendon. And that can be done by anyone who's comfortable doing it. It's not a complicated injection. Can be done by a family doc who injects it. Can be done by a hand surgeon. Can be done by an orthopedic surgeon, physician assistant. It's an easy thing. And frankly, for some people, that's the fix. And I talk as one of experience. I have a trigger finger in my right hand, my right third finger, and I've had two injections, and both have lasted for about 2 years. And at one point, I may need surgery. Quite often, trigger finger doesn't get better, and you need surgery to sort of open up the area so the tendon in the hand, a little pulley, can move freely. But sometimes injections are all that you need, and that'll work too. That's, I would recommend it. And if she's doing a lot of prep work and it's bothering her, have her do it. She's not going to want to go back to work that day, but she can certainly go back to work the next day.
Okay.
Does that help?
Good to know. Yes. Thank you very much for
your
help. Yeah,
you're welcome. Exercises won't do anything, and it's an uncomfortable thing when you actually have it, because we use our hands and we don't think about them.
Oh, yeah, no, it definitely bothers her. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call. Good luck with your daughter.
I've never noticed you with a trigger finger.
Yeah, that's because I don't use it. You've never noticed me with my trigger finger when I have. Well, I would notice it. You would notice it because I wouldn't take it, open up my hand. I mean, I might do it, but you never look. You know, Tom, you never pay attention. You don't even know how I dress. If I cover my eyes, you don't even know what color my eyes are. We've been doing this for years. How can you recommend, how could you look at trigger finger? You don't even know how tall I am. You know, I'm just sitting at this
You
desk.
Sound like a wife.
I hope she's listening.
I didn't say my wife. I said a wife. 800-462-7413. So, Zorba, we have some info on overdiagnoses and their problems with health.
Right. Well, it's a major issue. And let me give the perfect example. You can go around the country now and you'll see advertisements in the newspapers. Get a CAT scan of your body and find out if you have cancer. Okay? And what will happen is if they do a CAT scan of your body, they don't tell you about the side effects of that much radiation to your body. And there's a lot of radiation with a whole body CAT scan. It's not small. So nobody talks about that. Well, that's one part of overdiagnosis, right? You're going to have radiation done for a test. The second part is they will often find something. They'll find calcifications somewhere in the body. And they'll say, well, you've got a calcification in your lung. Maybe you have lung cancer there. And all of a sudden, you've got a biopsy. All of a sudden, you have other tests that are done for no reason at all. So that's one good example.
Okay.
Here's another good example.
Okay.
If I take people 50 years of age and older, and I do an MRI of their back, 20 to 25% of them will have slip discs. What percentage of those people you think will ever have had significant back pain? 25% will have slip discs. Of those 25%, what percentage have back pain?
I don't have any idea.
It's probably less than 5%.
Really?
Less than 5%. So in other words,
they have
slip,
no
quote, no symptoms at all. I mean, they may have an ache or a pain, but they don't have symptoms of neuropathic back pain from the disc. Mm-hmm. So in other words, here you have an overdiagnosis. All of a sudden, somebody comes in, they have back pain. You've got an MRI scan. The MRI scan shows a slip disc. That may not be causing the pain. They go to the wrong back surgeon and they go, oh, you've got a slip disc. I'm going to do surgery. It's going to, you know, be $5,000 in my pocket. I'm not saying all neurosurgeons. No. I'm saying some neurosurgeons. And all of a sudden, the overdiagnosis has then produced a surgery, an expense, and a surgical procedure you don't need. That's the problem right now.
And this happens with some frequency?
Oh, it happens all the time. And the present estimate is that it may be responsible for up to 25% of the total medical budget that we spend in America. You know, America spends more on health care than any other society. And, you know, our stats are not the best at all. Our statistics are really not very good. Even if you separate out middle class, you compare middle class Americans, we'll say, to middle class Canadians and Europeans, they still have better statistics than we do, but we do a lot more tests. You can't go into a doctor with a joint pain now without getting a CAT scan, an X-ray, or an MRI scan.
I've got to think this has something to do with money and insurance, and since we have the thing paid for and supposedly by somebody else, mm-hmm. they were more likely to do this.
Well, of course. I mean, I'm sure that's part of it. You know, do I know what my health plan costs? Well, my wife and I are on my health plan.
Yeah.
Our daughter just got off. I had no idea. I called up the health plan, and our health plan, we have a very good health plan through our group, is, I don't know, it's like $11,000 or $12,000 a year. It's a ton of money.
Yeah.
Now, if I had to write out a check every month for that health plan, I would be more cognizant of anything that I would do in terms of tests.
Yeah, and if you
You're
had
right.
to, if you had to write out a check for every medical procedure
Absolutely.
You do.
And then get reimbursed by my insurance company, I would ask about it. But that's only one part. I'll tell you what the other part is. It's totally different. It's habit. It's habit. It's training of doctors, and it's habit. The number of CAT scans that are done in the emergency room today is there are five times more CAT scans done today in the ER than there were 6 years ago. Five times more CAT scans done than there were 6 years ago. Do you think there's – I mean, do you think we need this many CAT scans? Five times. Huge number of CAT scans.
Well, you could say maybe 6 years ago they weren't finding things that
– No. If you look at ERs and what we've actually picked up with the CAT scans, it is a minimal output. Now, you may want to do – 50% more CAT scans, but not five times more CAT scans. And that's the issue, and that's why our health care goes up. Anyway, this particular overdiagnosis and over-testing is a big issue, especially since we all have to pay lots of dollars for our health care in America.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello there.
How can we help?
Well, I have an issue with my eyelids where once in a while, a couple times a year, in my sleep, something happens and it will go behind my eyeball. And I do mean behind the eyeball. I wake up panicked, frightened, and an eyelid will be, you know, past the top of the eyeball. Mm-hmm. And I have to use my fingers to pull it back out.
Well, Zorba says, I say I've never heard it. I can understand why you'd freak out at that. Have you had that all your life?
No, I don't think so anyways. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly when it started, but I would say at least the last 8 to 10 years.
Uh-huh. How often does it happen?
Probably maybe 3 to 6 times a year.
Uh-huh. 3 to 6 times a year. Now, do you have any droopy eyes? Are your eyelids droopy?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. And I also probably should say that I do have kind of big, goggly, bulging eyes.
Big, goggly, bulging eyes. You know,
I have big eyes, and I've been commented on all my life.
Oh, you mean everyone says, boy, you have big eyes?
Yes.
Oh. Do they say it with a smile?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Maybe because, seriously. No, it's for. Here's the issue that may be there. There's something called the tarsal plate. I think that's what it's called. But you can, when I flip an eyelid up, because if I want to look underneath the eyelid, not the eyeball, but the eyelid to see if there's a foreign body, such as a piece of dust, there's a ridge in your eyelid. And that ridge separates the upper part of the eyelid and the lower part of the eyelid. And when you open up your eyes, generally that ridge is the part that the eye, when you open up your eyes, stops at. You know, your lids don't disappear completely when you open it up. Mm-hmm. It stops generally at about that ridge. And it sounds to me like something has occurred because, as you said, you have large eyes. So that ridge, when you're sleeping, just slips under the eyeball. And then, as you said, it's freaky. And then you're able to reach in there and pull it forward. I mean, how long does it take you, by the way, to pull it forward?
Oh, not very long at all. It's
What's not very long? A second? 2 seconds?
Yeah.
Okay.
Once I get enough awareness.
Right. Once you realize that's what it is. And as you say, it's a freaky feeling. It doesn't feel good. I believe if this bothers you enough, there is a treatment for this, which is a plastic surgical treatment. And it's similar to what we do in eyes that are droopy eyes. And what will happen is for some people, especially when they get older, their eyes become so droopy that it actually begins to cover their pupil and they can't see as well peripherally. And they have a plastic surgical procedure whereby the eyelid itself is tightened up a little bit, sort of like a, you know, just like it's tightened up a little bit, sort of just like a facelift. It's an eye lift. And I'm not talking about this as a plastic surgical procedure for vanity, which people also do because they want to appear to be more awake. But this procedure may be helpful for what you have. So if you want to pursue it, the treatment would be to go to an ophthalmologist who specializes in eyelids, does eyelid procedures, and talk to them. And there's some testing they can do to see if that would be worthwhile.
Well, yeah, that's great. I mean, at least now I know a direction to look in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you make this happen if you want to? Can you do it?
No.
I'm going to say that'd be fun to, you know, freak out your friends.
Certainly, I've talked with some friends about it, and they think I should keep a camera next to the bed because they'd like to know what that looks like.
They want to see it.
And funnily enough, I actually, there was a time where there was lots of family over, and I had to share a bed with someone. Mm-hmm. And it happened in the middle of the night, and I woke up, and I'm saying, look, and they didn't wake up, and I couldn't wait any longer.
So you would show it off if you could.
Yes, I would. I'm curious to know what it looks like myself.
Well, let us know what happens.
Thanks for the call.
I sure will. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Zorba, before we take our first short break, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. On a past show, we spoke to a young mother about the use of Tylenol with vaccines for infants. You explained that Tylenol has no effect on the vaccine whatsoever. You went even further, stating that, in fact, Tylenol could be useful for the baby if taken beforehand. Well, several listeners flooded our inbox and voicemail to take you to task on both fronts. Tolga from Duluth, Minnesota, disagrees with you, but may take the prize for the most polite dissent ever in the history of Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tolga writes, "Dear Zorba, I love your show. A caller called in and stated she had been told by her nurse not to administer Tylenol to her daughter prior to vaccination. You insisted that there is no data to back this up and insisted she correct her nurse as to not propagate faulty information." Well, Tolga then links to the study, which you're familiar with, and continues, "I also heard that it might not be good to administer Tylenol prior to a vaccine, and there indeed has been a recent study that suggests this might be true." Tolga then links to another study to debunk that claim, but concludes with, "Zorba, I love your show and your banter with Tom. Keep up the great work." This all sounds confusing to me, Zorba.
Well, I'll tell you what the issue is. And then I looked at these particular studies. So first of all, the advice I gave that I traditionally do, and actually will still traditionally do, is give some Tylenol or Motrin prior to the vaccine. The studies, and I looked at, there were a couple of studies, but the study published in The Lancet, which we'll put on our website, mm-hmm. zorbapastor.org, so we'll put a link to that study on the website, looked at Tylenol, looked at acetaminophen in Europe called paracetamol. It has a slightly different name. It was a study done, it was a Czech study, it's called. It was called an open label type study. And they looked at kids who got Tylenol, kids who didn't. They measured the fever afterwards and measured fussiness. And sure enough, the ones who received Tylenol were less fussy at certain times within the study. So it did reduce that. What they found when they looked at antibodies at different times, and they didn't go out very far. They were antibodies within a rather short period of time, that Tylenol appeared to attenuate or decrease the antibody response. Now, They concluded then that if you give Tylenol, you won't have the same robustness for antibodies that will produce a lifelong immunity to what you're doing. And I think that's a stretch. I think that's an absolute stretch. In other words, the antibodies at the times that they measured it do not necessarily represent the antibodies that are going to be there 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years down the line. So from my point of view, the jury is still completely out on this. We do know it stops the fussiness and decreases the fever. But I don't think you can conclude that it reduces the immunogenicity of the vaccination. And that was the point of the study. And in fact, the authors actually discuss that at the end, and they say we need to have more study on this, which is always a common disclaimer.
The purpose of the Tylenol ahead of time is strictly a comfort thing.
Oh, yeah, it's comfort for the baby. They often get three or four shots.
Isn't the possible problem more important than the comfort level?
Well, this is a very interesting issue. We give Tylenol and we give ibuprofen for children when they have fevers. There's no that we're actually only treating the fever, and there's evidence that a child may be better without a fever of staying with that fever of 103 because they get a more robust antibody response. Now, as the father of four children, let me tell you, when the child is fussy, I like to treat the child with a fever. That's exactly what we do. So I think if you make a response to this, then you say, well, we should never give Tylenol or ibuprofen with a child with a fever. We should not be giving it very often because they need to develop a more robust antibody response to common viruses, when in fact, they still do develop that immunogenicity of the viruses. So I thought it was a very interesting study. There have not been multiple studies. You need more than one study. And I like the fact that they disagreed with me.
Interesting. If you need to pop a Tylenol after Zorba offers his advice, let us know during our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. A good recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls. Our medical Mythbuster 2 right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time. This one, Zorba, for smoked turkey and cranberry salad. Yummy.
Yummy, yummy, yummy.
This is comfort food.
Yeah, it's comfort food. It's, summer comfort food this time of year. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. So, and I like comfort food,
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
It's comfortable.
Like comfort food? And I like simple. Sometimes I like to do more complex recipes, but I also like nice, simple type recipes.
And that's what this is?
Yep.
Okay,
so you start out with 4 cups of leaf lettuce. It really doesn't have to be leaf lettuce. You could use romaine lettuce. You could use red lettuce. You can use any kind of lettuce. I wouldn't use iceberg. You could use spring mix in something like this.
Does anybody use iceberg lettuce anymore?
Well, I see it at the store.
That's all I had when I was a kid.
Yeah, somebody must buy it. Now, I do like a wedge, where you take the whole rounded salad and you ball and cut it into quarters.
Four slices.
Yeah,
I hate that hunk of lettuce and put a little dressing in.
See, now you hate that. You really don't like that at all.
No.
See, now when I'm at a restaurant, if I can order iceberg lettuce with some French blue dressing on it, and some nuts, I'm in heaven.
Okay.
Of course, I never make it at home, so maybe I'm not in heaven.
4 cups of leaf lettuce or otherwise torn into bite-sized pieces.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Then 6 ounces of smoked turkey. And if you don't want to use smoked turkey, you certainly could use chicken, but really sliced smoked turkey deli meat, about 6 ounces.
6 ounces smoked turkey, deli meat slice.
That's right. An apple, I use a Gala apple with this. You could use a Honeycrisp, or you could certainly use, I wouldn't use a Red Delicious. Mm-hmm. We've gone up into Red Delicious in discussions
about
Red Delicious.
Yeah, right. I lost that argument.
But you could use a Granny Smith, too.
This is half of it, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, half of a Gala apple, maybe Granny Smith. 3 tablespoonfuls of dried cranberries.
Mm-hmm. 3 big tea dried cranberries.
Okay, and then you're going to use some salt and pepper on this. And I would use a little bit of salt. I generally salt and pepper when things are all finished. But a little salt and pepper, only fresh ground pepper. Do you have fresh ground pepper at home? At your house? You just take it right out. Do you use pepper at the house?
If I needed pepper, I'd have to actually cook something. Why would I want pepper when I never have any food there to put it on?
Oh, anyway. I have such an image. The pantry is bare. Yeah. Trying to think of what the rhyme was, you know, where there was no pantry, like the rhyme with the woman with the nine.
I've never heard of that. Anyway.
You know what? I bet some of our listeners will send us a nursery rhyme where there wasn't enough food in the house.
Okay.
That's what I need.
Okay.
Because my brain is blocked from that.
So now we have dressing.
Okay. Now the dressing we have is 2 tablespoonfuls of veggie oil. And what I would use, of course, is extra virgin olive oil.
Right. 2 big tea vegetable oil.
Right. Buy some good extra virgin olive oil. I recently read an article in Cooks Illustrated, my favorite cooking magazine, where they show that extra virgin olive oil really counts on something like a salad and doesn't count nearly as much in cooking. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't count
as much. That's my favorite cooking magazine, too.
Right. That's right for all that you read. 3 tablespoonfuls of apple cider vinegar.
3 big tea, apple cider vinegar.
Has a nice taste to it. 1 tablespoonful of minced shallots.
A big tea, minced shallots.
Mm-hmm. You know, mince away. Mm-hmm. 1 teaspoon of Dijon mustard. Mm-hmm.
A little tea Dijon mustard.
And 1/2 teaspoon of sugar.
Half a little tea sugar.
And if you want to add some spice to your life, you could use 1/2 teaspoon of honey. Honey would be good, too, in this.
Okay.
So combine the salad ingredients in a large bowl, then season with salt and pepper, freshly ground pepper, then whisk the salad dressing. You see, whisk everything in the salad dressing together so that you've got it all together in the bowl until it's nice and blended. And then divide up your nice little dish. Put some salad dressing on the top and bon appetit.
Yeah.
You've got a wonderful, wonderful, very simple, easy recipe that anyone in your family, anyone in your family can enjoy. And it's really, it's a low caloric recipe, which of course is the most important thing when it comes to things like this.
Now, if one of our listeners or 2 or 3 want a copy of this, you're not going to hand deliver it.
No, I'm not going to hand deliver it. That's right. You're going to have to go to the website zorbapastor.org, and you can look on our website. You can then search all your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes, and you can even sign up for a podcast. That's zorbapastor.org, and don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phones we go, Zorba, with a listener in Branson, Missouri. Hi.
Howdy.
How can we help?
Well, I hope you can. I have a question about soy. I have a protein powder that I'm in love with, and it has a high-quality whey protein. It has non-GMO soy in it. It has other vitamins and minerals in it. However, the more research I do on soy, the more concerned I get of consuming it and giving it to my children, specifically the phytoestrogens in it. And I can read both sides of the argument, and I just don't know who has what agenda. I would love to get your opinion on non-GMO soy.
And the soy that they're using is the soy that's not genetically modified. I mean, that's what you mean by non-GMO. It took me a second to get my brain around non-GMO, and I thought, what's non-GMO? And then all of a sudden, genetics pops in, and of course, soy genes come together because we know that Monsanto has lots of issues with soy. Let's go to the issue at hand. First of all, whey protein, of course, is dairy protein. Whey comes from a milk source. So we know what that is, and people have opinions about that, especially the vegans of the world have an opinion about that. So we'll put that to the side for a second. So how much soy are you consuming a day? I mean, how many scoops of this, of the powder are you using?
Well, I usually just have one smoothie a day.
Mm-hmm.
And each smoothie is about 6 grams of soy protein. And I'm also an omnivore and consume, you know, I was raised on a farm and we have our own beef, mm-hmm. and all of that.
Sure.
So it's not my only source. It's just a concern of if that's affecting my hormone levels and my children.
I don't think so. I think that's fine. I think that's within a balanced diet, and my opinion is that's completely acceptable. Now, if you said to me, no, we've given up, we only eat soy, that's our sole source of our major source of protein, and we're having, you know, soy in the morning, soy in the afternoon, soy in the evening, tofu for dessert at night, mm-hmm. and you're eating nothing but soy protein, I think that's a different issue. And to make an analogy, let me make the analogy with salt. We actually need a certain amount of salt in our body, but we don't need a lot of salt, and Americans eat too much salt. But in areas where there's no salt at all, people actually have other renal problems, other kidney problems, because they have no salt in their diet. It hardly exists in the world anymore, but it used to years ago. So a certain amount of salt is okay, but no salt isn't, and too much salt, you know, is not good. I think it's the same with a lot of things, and I think soy fits within that realm. A scoop or two of a soy protein powder once a day is not going to be bothersome. If it's only soy, I think that's where the bothersome thing is. So I would give it to my kids, and I would take it myself.
Got it. Thank you.
Good luck. You've noticed, though, when you read websites, you get strong opinions about soy, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes, that's exactly it. Well, websites can be garbage in and garbage out. So thanks for listening.
I hear you. Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. A line is open for you right now if you'd like to call. As we move along now, Zorba, to a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello.
Hello, hello.
How can we help?
I have occasional sneezing fits. They only happen after a large meal. Maybe one or two glasses of wine. I thought it might be an air freshener or sanitizer in the restroom, but it happens even when I don't use the restrooms. I usually sneeze about 15 times. It did happen once after eating while I was still in the restaurant and once after we got home, but every other time it's just in the car on the way home. We thought it might be the air conditioning in the car or something like that. We didn't use air. Still happens.
Well, the problem is you have to quit going to these restaurants where the meals are $7.95.
That could be. I'll tell my wife.
Yeah, where are you eating? Tell me what kind of restaurants they are.
Any kind of Mexican restaurant, seafood.
Okay.
I don't know if I can say the restaurant.
Okay, but there are a variety of different restaurants that you're actually going to. By the way, good thoughts. Maybe it's the air freshener, of course, and in bathrooms they use air freshener all the time. Good thought. Maybe there's something in the car. We get in the car and I start sneezing away. Maybe there's something in the car. That's also, by the way, still a possibility. Pretty remote in my mind, but sneezing in the car, I certainly would think about dust or something else that could be the case. So those are certainly good thoughts that those indeed might be the problems that are actually there. More likely than not, it's just like gustatory sweating. And gustatory sweating is when you sweat during a meal or after a meal. And it's just, it's part of the autonomic nervous system. And it's just a response to the acid that you're producing in the stomach. And essentially the acid you're producing and all of the digestive processes that are going on. And if it isn't that, well, it may be the size of the meal that you're having. And some people find if they eat less at a meal, they actually don't sweat or they don't sneeze, which is really a variation that's near that. And if that all fails, then I would stop eating out and I would eat at home. So 15 times, who's driving the car?
I am.
Well, you know, when you sneeze, your eyes close.
I know.
Have you gotten into an accident yet?
No.
Well, why don't you have your wife drive?
That's a good idea.
This is wife drive the car week so we don't crash. That's exactly it. Well, let us know what happens. Seriously, try that experiment and give us a call back.
Okay, we'll do. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks. Thank you very much. We appreciate the call. Before another short break, Zorba, let's log in to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take this quick question from Dave in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Dave writes, I have a 25-year-old son who sometimes does what single 25-year-old males do. I was wondering if he should get the HPV vaccine, or is he too old at 25?
So, in other words, a 25-year-old son is having sex.
Oh, way to go. Good, good. You caught on, Zorba.
And you know what? And you know what's shocking? So are the 25-year-old girls or women, because at 25, if I called them girls, if I called my daughter a girl who's 26, she'd have a fit. The answer is yes. Under the age of 26, the recommendation, and frankly, even if the exact recommendations are not 26, the answer is yes. There are two questions. First of all, the HPV vaccine, fascinating issues, and they really are social issues. There's pushback in some communities for girls. The idea is to get the HPV vaccine before you're sexually active. Mm-hmm. There's pushback in many communities, number of communities, for girls in saying, no, we don't want our child to get the HPV vaccine because we think it encouraged sexual behavior. Yeah. I mean, this is an argument. But when it comes to boys in the same community, only a quarter of the parents have a pushback with the boy. It's very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah, this goes way back. This
but
is
it's
forever.
But it's forever. But it's a very important issue because because the fact is there's a herd, something we call the herd effect. If we can get HPV out of the environment, we reduce cervical cancer dramatically. And so the feds finally came out and said we should be treating boys and girls, young men and women, and this will be very useful for women to keep them from developing cervical cancer. So the answer is yes, definitely get the vaccine, highly recommended. And the fact is it should be done. It's a series of shots, and it's usually covered by health insurance. Got to check it out before you get that shot.
Well, you're never too old to send in a question or to do what never too old males and females sometimes do. Just send your lifestyle questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some important research to talk about. That's coming up. More of your calls, our medical myth buster as well, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up in just a bit, but first, Zorba, what's this AARP study on caregivers?
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, baby boomers are getting older. I know that's a shock, but baby boomers are actually...
As opposed to everybody else.
Everybody else, that's exactly. Yeah. Boomers never age, but boomers do age. And the problem is, the problem is we're living longer than we did before, but often after the age of 75, 80, you begin to have some disability. Many people have it before then. And so you need to have people that will help you, maybe get up in the morning, maybe bathe, maybe shop for you. Well, it turns out the number of people in that age group of helpers, 45, 50 years old, often helping people who are older, is shrinking. In other words, in 2010, there were about 7 individuals per capita that could do this. That's going to drop to 4 individuals per capita. So in other words, the pool of potential employees of baby boomers to help them live is shrinking.
Yeah, but isn't there a supply and demand going on here? If there's a need for more, won't more people want to go into that?
Well,
one
of the problems is that we don't have as many younger people in our society anymore. Society is aging. So in other words, the people in this age group are not as many as before. Now, it might be that what you'll have is you'll have younger people in their 20s who begin to help the boomers because there'll be a supply of that. Or maybe there'll be an open immigration in the society for people to help boomers, right? Maybe there'll be a change in federal policy, just like you have workers that work in the farm fields. You might have that. But it really is going to be a problem because as you get older and you want to live, it's an issue.
Isn't that already kind of a problem in our society?
Well, it's a problem because of, once again, like you say, it's supply and demand. It's a problem with money. Generally, caregivers are not the highest paid people in our society. And what you may find out that this particular problem will be solved by increasing the wage, maybe making it a two-year program that you take at a college, at a technical college. But unless we have some step up in this, it's going to be a problem as boomers age and as the number of people to help them shrink.
Yeah, we have a jobs problem now, of course, and I'm just wondering if that's going to be exacerbated by this, people not being able to make enough money to pay for these carriers.
Exactly. Well, when you look at the older population, people over 65, one-third of those people live on Social Security. That's it. That's all they have. They might have a few thousand dollars in the bank, but it's a third. It used to be a half, but it's dropped to a third. So imagine here you are. You're a shut-in. You're in a city. You're living on Social Security. You don't have enough money to be able to pay the going rate for people to take care of you. The government comes in and says, you're on medical assistance. We're going to help you. Well, the problem is this is financial and this is population. So the good news is we're living longer, and the bad news is we may not have enough people to help us.
To the phones again now, Zorba. Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Dothan, Alabama. Hi.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm a runner, and I've been running for about 7 years now. And I haven't had it in a while, but I keep getting a case of black toe on my secondary toe. And I was just kind of curious to know how it happens and what I could do to prevent it.
Yeah, a case of what did you say?
Black toe.
What's that?
Black toe is kind of like a bruise up underneath the toenail, and it causes your toenail to fall off.
Oh, and you get it from running, yeah.
That's exactly it. So what do you like to run? Are you a long-distance runner, sprinter? Tell me a little bit about your running.
Well, I'm a long-distance runner. I do cross-country and track for my high school down here, Northview High School, and I've been doing it for 5-6 years now.
Uh-huh. Are you good?
I am. I'm the fastest for both of my areas, and I'm close to being one of the fastest in the mile and 2 mile in Alabama.
Oh, that's way cool. That is absolutely way cool. So if you look at what black toe is from, and if you look at, for instance, black toe ingrown toenails, because they're not exactly the same by any means, but they're similar. It's due to trauma of the foot going into the end of the shoe, and it occurs when you're running. If you're kicking a ball with soccer, it occurs there. But in your case, when it's running, it's because the lift off, and you're headed down with that toe, and your foot is constantly going into the end of the shoe. So it's a matter. There are a couple of things that you can do. First of all, how are your shoes? They're good shoes, I take it?
Yes, sir, they are. I wear all kinds of different shoes, and I rotate out throughout the year. I'll wear like 6 or 7 pairs of shoes.
57 pairs of
shoes?
Oh, 6 or 7 pairs of shoes. That's really good. And rotating makes a big difference because it gets the moisture out of the foot. There are a couple of things you can try. Number one, you can try taping the second toe to the third toe with a little cotton in between and see if that does anything, because that often will keep one toe from going in as far to the other toe. It's splinting it together. Now, the reason why you got to check to see what it's doing is you want to make sure it doesn't affect your running. It probably won't. It may feel a little different, but that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do other than that is actually tape the toe. You just get the regular tape that you would use that's bandage tape. But there's a tape called Transpore, Transpore. It's made by 3M, and it's a tape that actually has little holes in it so your toe can breathe. Your toe doesn't really breathe. But it's got some air. And sometimes just taping the toe itself, not even next to the next toe, can also make a difference. But this is from trauma, and it's either taping, buddy splinting it, number two and number three, or just taping it individually. That can make a difference.
Okay, because I had a real bad case of it during my cross-country season, and I haven't had it since. My toenails still haven't come back from it.
It still hasn't come. And it may, you know what? As long as you're a competitive runner, the nail may not come back, but believe it or not, nails are incredibly durable, and it'll come back. It'll come back sometime in your life. That's usually what happens. But keep up the good work. It's a great, great sport, and it's really a great lifetime sport for you.
Yes, sir, it is.
So that's great. So you're on the way to a meet, huh?
Well, actually, no. I'm on my way to Parris Island, South Carolina, with my ROTC group.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, you have a great time.
Wait a minute. What are you going to be up to at Parris Island?
We're just doing a little 3-day boot camp up here.
That'll be fun.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, and thanks for listening to Public Radio. It's great to have young listeners.
Thank you for helping me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. Toll free, of course. And Zorba, time now for a medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with dental health. If brushing your teeth is good, then brushing them immediately after eating is even better. Right?
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. That's, of course, what I think. And in fact, there's one of the docs in our office immediately after he eats brushes his teeth. However, there are some dentists and some research that shows that maybe the acid in your mouth after you're eating is not good because you're taking the acid, pushing it into the enamel. And then there was a study that showed a group of volunteers followed for several weeks look at impact of brushing their teeth after they drank diet soda. Mm-hmm. But diet soda can be somewhat acidic in the mouth, and lo and behold, it was considerably less wear and tear when brushing took place 30 to 60 minutes after they drank the diet soda versus immediately after the diet soda. So the long and the short of it is the acid that's produced in your mouth after you're eating may indeed adversely affect your teeth when you're brushing it. On the other hand, let's assume that just like one of my partners in the office, he brushes his teeth after he eats every single time, and he hasn't had a cavity in 30 years. I'll go with the not having a cavity in 30 years versus the study. Obviously, the guy takes care of his teeth. Somebody who brushes their teeth after each meal, probably flosses at night, is going to have better teeth at all. So I would say if you want to brush, by all means, do it.
Yeah, but if you have a meal and there isn't a toothbrush handy,
Don't worry.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to sink his teeth into? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones we go now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Thornhill, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great. How can we help?
I have dry patches on my face, which I have not been able to get rid of. They've been there since probably last summer, last fall. Mm-hmm. I use wood heat in the winter. Summer is all the windows open.
Mm-hmm.
Over my eyebrow, on my forehead, I have an especially dry patch. Mm-hmm. And under my nose, over my lip, I have another very dry patch. I mean, if they feel like they've got little scabs on them, but there's no scab there. If I rub them, they don't even bleed, but they are awful. Then my temples and the sides of my cheeks, the top of my nose are all very, very dry. I mean, I look flaky.
Ouch. And you haven't ever had this before a few months ago?
I've had it since probably last fall, early last fall, so mm-hmm. probably 9 months.
First of all, as you said, use wood heat in the wintertime, which, of course, is drying. That
That's
dries
right.
out your skin.
And I keep water kettles on mm-hmm. the stove.
What kind of soap do you use to wash?
I don't use soap.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you don't have drying soap. What do you shower with?
Water,
okay. So you don't use soap when you shower either?
No, sir.
How come? Dry out your skin too much?
It just sort of my philosophy. Mm-hmm. You just get in there and you just scrub away.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I try to use natural remedies, mm-hmm. and if I use soap, it's more of a natural, like goat uh-huh. soap or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're obviously suffering from dry skin. In the wintertime, first of all, one of the things that people do when they have dry skin is sometimes they put a vaporizer on in the room. The kettles on the stove may not be enough. It's all a function of whether, you know, on the wood-burning stove. It's a function of whether or not the room steams up. If the windows steam up, then you know it's a moist room for sure. So in the wintertime, you want to look and see if it steams up. That gives you an idea. The other thing is, what has happened is your skin is dried out. You just can't – your skin, since it's only been there for 9 months, just sort of can't get on top of it. And what I would recommend initially, have you tried an aloe-type cream?
That's what I've been using. Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't done it.
That isn't doing it.
Okay. Then you may have to go to a medicated cream. I mean, that if the aloe has not done it, aloe is very good directly from the plant. Right on there is excellent. We'll often do it. Let me give you the oldest remedy on the planet, which is more natural than hydrocortisone, although hydrocortisone works. And I would use a tar shampoo. And because you can't buy tar without it, with the shampoo. And you go to the drugstore and you get You ask the druggist for what's the mildest tar shampoo. And it's a shampoo that we use for dandruff and psoriasis. And you just take that tar shampoo, put it on your face, just let it go right over the blotches, let it sit there for a few minutes, and then wash it off. And tar can be very, very good to essentially get rid of this on the skin. I wouldn't use regular tar because it'll stick to your skin, and that'll peel it off. But this is actually coal tar, and it's an old remedy, 100 years old, works well. That's number one. Vaseline may also work. Plain old petroleum jelly, which has nothing in it at all, may also do the trick. And if not, the next step is over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. And if that fails, because that's really very mild, then I'd go to a prescription strength. But I tried the tar shampoo first.
Thank you so much for your help. Have a good day.
Thank you so much for the call.
And before we leave for the week, Zorba, let's take one last quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Mary in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, who has an interesting question about the effects of living an emergency responder lifestyle. Mary writes, Dr. Zorba, I used to belong to and have family that currently belong to a volunteer fire department. I've always wondered if there's ever been a study of the effects of going from a deep sleep to full adrenaline when the pager goes off in the middle of the night. Your heart goes from 0 to 900 in a matter of seconds. Is this a bad thing? Thanks and love the show.
Well, first of all, there is evidence that suddenly waking up in the middle of the night, your blood pressure goes up suddenly, your pulse goes up suddenly, the adrenaline is shooting out suddenly. And yes, that is not necessarily the best thing for your heart. Now, let's look at the age group. If you're a volunteer firefighter and you have heart disease in your mid-60s and all of a sudden your pulse goes up and everything, it's going to be – there's an element of danger there. But if you're in your 20s or your 30s or your 40s and your 50s, it's clearly going to be less dangerous. So the answer is it basically is a risk, and it just comes with the – with exactly what you're doing. It comes with the territory. There's not much you can do about it. I know, because when I was – I still work. I don't take call as often as I used to, but I was on call 1 out of 3, did a lot of deliveries, and when I got a call in the middle of the night, an OB, and they said, she's at 9 centimeters, you better believe, my pulse went up, my heart rate up, and I ran out of there, and you know what? My heart was the last thing I thought about as I was getting into my car and speeding off.
We're here, even in the middle of the night, to help with your lifestyle issues. So if you have a question for the show, just send it along in an email or page to
Zorba@WPR.org. Does anyone still use a pager? Yes, they do.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Executive producer Adam Jax Friedrich and technical director Brad Clay Kohlberg are the two anarchists on the other side of the glass responsible for this hour. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0907Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.